Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. I have with me one of the great actors working in Chicago, somebody who is very much admired, somebody who I believe could perform the phone book and make it interesting. Say hello to Francis Guinan.
Hi, how are you?
Tell us about your latest show.
Oh, The Night Alive. It's a Connor McPherson play. This, I think, is the third or fourth play of his we've done. Previous to this, we did The Weir, also The Seafarer, and now this play, which is was very recently in New York. And I have to say, this play is slightly different from his other work. Are you familiar with The Weir?
Oh, yes. I've seen several productions, including the one here.
Very elegiac, very long speeches. Mm-hmm. You know, well, they're all telling ghost stories, of course. So you have time to develop some. This is far sharper. This is very staccato musically. The dialogue is... a lot of times references something that the audience doesn't always quite pick up, except by that you sort of extrapolate information.
And it's a kind of a mystery too, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It is actually.
And he deliberately kind of throws us as an audience off on maybe what's going to happen or what did happen.
It's an interesting thing. He was saying during rehearsal, we were fortunate enough, Henry Wishkamper has a long relationship with Conor McPherson. We were fortunate enough to get Conor to come in, and he was saying he doesn't much care. In fact, he sort of enjoys the fact that the audience gets a little lost. They don't know quite what's going on at the top of the scene or where they are sort of temporally. But you pick up on it after like a page or two. But he sort of likes that idea of the audience being sort of off balance a little bit. And then they pick up the story.
So how does that influence your performance? Because you're the main guy in the, you're Tommy in the.
Yeah. Now, obviously, I have to know what's going on. But a lot of it ended up getting... I mean, you can infer a lot of things from the script about what's happened to the characters previously. McPherson isn't terribly helpful in this script, though. You don't know very many of the specifics. You run into characters, I play the character of Tommy. Tommy's ex-wife, Suzanne, his daughter, Michelle, his son, who has no name in the play. But, I mean, all those people...
See, I missed the son. I didn't know he had a son.
Well, you remember he said he's got that line, "So how old are your kids?" Amy asks. And he says, 16 and 17. The older one's a girl, and the other fellow's a boy.
Okay. So, I missed that. Very good.
I probably wasn't speaking loudly.
No, you were. I could hear you fine.
but again, I mean, this is somewhat different in that it's musically quite different from his other plays, and also I think relies a great deal, Shining City more so, but also relies a lot on sort of magical thinking, magical realism.
Mm-hmm.
There is some I won't go into that, but when you see the play, it's the last scene may or may not be very strange, depending on how you interpret the play.
Well, we're still arguing about it.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Which is, I think, what he wanted, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. Well, it's like in Shining City when, you know, the guy comes home and closes the door and out pops this ghost, like out of nowhere. It just scares the hell out of the audience. But you're wondering, what the hell is that? What's he doing there?
What draws you to McPherson's work?
Well, I was raised Roman Catholic, an Irish Roman Catholic. And to give you an idea of what kind of family I grew up in, my grandmother, my father's dad, her maiden name is Blanche Coughlin. And Blanche was born here. As I recall, was born in the States, but her family was all, you know, the black Irish Catholic, and still had her brogue and everything. And when she'd come to visit, I was the only, I was a little kid. And so I did have a big bed and a room to myself, but it was the only place for guests to stay. So consequently, my grandmother would come and she'd take her holy water out and pull the bed sheets down, spread holy water all over the sheets, put the first sheet down, spread more holy water, the blanket, more holy water, and finally the top cover, and put more holy water on it. And we'd say the rosary before we'd go to bed.
So that's real Irish.
I know. I was lying in this damp bed with my beads. It was my grandma Blanche saying the rosary. So that's, anyway, we have similar backgrounds, McPherson and I. But he's also, he's very interested in redemption. And the thing I liked so much about, well, for instance, Seafarer, is that it's a very Catholic play. Theologically.
Yeah, it is.
Because you, and yet it's sort of Vatican II Catholicism as well, because it's not so much that one commits a mortal sin and goes to hell, you know, and burns in the fire of sulfurous fires. It's that one lives in a state of separation from God. And that's where that character finds himself. He's separated from his family, from the better spiritual part of himself. And that's why he's living. That's why the devil comes. That he invites Satan into his life. And that's what he discovers during the course of the play. I mean, not literally in the dialogue, but in terms of the performance of it.
So you're saying that your Catholic background just feeds right into
exactly what that was about.
Okay.
I knew exactly what that was about. So, and in much the same way, Tommy in The Night Alive is alienated from the better parts of his life. I mean, he's always striving for the get rich quick scheme. And then when you arrive at the end of the play, there's a description of heaven that's given, mm-hmm. that your life just falls together. And, you know, it's that old Irish saying, may you be in heaven half an hour before the devil knows you're dead.
That's right.
And that's the definition of heaven. You won't even know you're dead. Things will just work out perfectly.
That's a great thought.
It is a great thought.
All right. Let me ask you this. What I've noticed in your work, and it really, really happened in The Night Alive, was how quickly and easily you get the audiences to like you. That you evoke that empathy in your character. Yet we know, and you play a lot of flawed characters.
Yeah.
And yet we like you, and we care.
Oh, I think people recognize that. I mean, you couldn't get through. One could not get through the day without feeling you were at least, you were taking up too much space, you know, unjustly in the world. That there was something redeeming about the way that you were living your life. And I think people see that immediately, and certainly in Night Alive, that's the character plays into that very easily. Mm-hmm. The problems in his life are very real. They're also very common. Estrangement from his family.
He's a dreamer.
He's broke.
Yeah.
He's broke all the time. I mean, a lot of people.
But he's
especially in Ireland and the States now know what that's about.
Yeah. But he's basically a good guy.
Yes.
You play good guys.
He is basically a good guy. I mean, I think in Seafarer, the guy there was a little darker. But it's interesting. Somebody left a comment the other night. We have comments that we solicit in the programs. why would I want to see a play about a bunch of losers? It was like scribbled angrily. And,
what's your answer for that?
Well, I mean, it's because we're all losers, you know, in one way or another. And at least getting in touch with that, I think, is far more educational than, you know, coming out, you know, hearing about heroes. I mean, Oedipus doesn't get really interesting until he really starts to screw up. Then the play,
yeah.
Then the play takes off.
That's so true.
Yeah.
What is your? How do you prepare for a role like this? Particularly, every you're doing 8 shows a week.
It's interesting. I know. I did a play with Bob Falls, and he had come back. He'd done a lot of study in Russia with Stanislavski in the Moscow Art Theater, and he was hardcore Stanislavski. I mean, that kind of preparation where you know, where did the character grow up? I mean, does he have a stutter? Does he limp? Does he, you know, what yeah. does his house look like, et cetera, et cetera. I don't usually do that, although I have to say I'd learned an awful lot from Bob, and I was, you know, well into my 50s when I did that role. The thing I think I try to memorize my lines. I memorize my lines, and I try to pay attention to what's going on with the other person, because it's like playing tennis. I mean, you can't really accomplish anything until somebody hits the ball at you. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you're constantly back and forth. It's literally a dialogue. I just do my best to pay attention to what the other actors are doing.
And you have certainly, since you've been back in Chicago, you've been getting great roles. And doing things with some top
actors. it's the best, career wise, it's the best thing that could have happened. I mean, we were out now. My wife and I were out in L.A. and she had been there much longer than I had. She's from Chicago as well, and she'd been out there casting and working for Gary Sinise at Columbia Pictures, and anyway, but that. It had finally come to the point where I'd had some pretty decent success out there, but the rent started getting higher and the business had changed a little bit. And you had like people who with major movie careers who were now taking television roles.
Yeah.
And doing voiceovers yeah. and doing beautifully with yeah. them. And, you know, it was just a little bit less work. So.
Did you miss the stage?
I did, and I'd been back. You know, I'd do a play every now and again, and I did. I had missed it, and I have to say, I enjoy doing film. The camera scares me a little bit, but I enjoy doing film. But the stage is really that's where I grew up. That's where I learned my craft, or at least the craft that I do have. That's is you know tuned up for stage work. So
in this The Night Alive, mm-hmm. Tim Hopper, and you really have is he amazing, isn't he?
Tim is unbelievable in this. Well, I should say he's completely believable, but you've never seen a person quite like this. I mean, Tim did the same thing I did. He and his family were in New York, and he was doing terrific. I mean, voiceover work and off Broadway and regional but it's so tough to make a living as an actor, especially New York, because it's so ridiculously expensive. And it's the coast right now. Okay, I'm going to have to answer that later. But Tim came back, and the kind of work he's been doing since he's been back, my God, it's just breathed life into the season. I mean, did you see a Russian Transport?
Absolutely. He was great in
that. He was the scariest guy.
Scariest Russian mob guy. And then
but you didn't know that when the play started. It just gets grimmer and grimmer and grimmer as the play goes on. And you're just terrified every time somebody's sitting in the room with him.
Yeah.
I'm so glad Tim's back. I'm so glad. The kind of work he's doing is just, it's spectacular.
And how about the young girl?
Oh, Helen?
Yeah.
Well, this is Helen's second show with us. She was in Tribes. Thank you. I couldn't think of the name. We're very fortunate. She was... we're very fortunate. Hold on just a second. I'll call you back, okay? I'm in an interview. Bye. we were so fortunate. She was available because she'd just done a movie right before she came back here to work. And, she was so good in Tribes.
Yes, she was. That was terrific work.
And in this, the work is far more shorthand it's a very tough role. And I'm so glad she was available.
We don't know much about her. And even when the play's over, your relationship with her, that's still subject to debate.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. It was lovely. Remember opening night? It was so neat. Oh, well, I shouldn't give this away, but, oh, well, should I? I don't know. Is it giving it away?
No.
Yeah. Anyway. But anyway, back, she comes in the door, they see each other, the lights go out, and suddenly someone in the audience goes, "Get out!" You know, and it's an ending that Connor McPherson described as like ridiculously happy ending. I mean, it's a movie happy ending.
Yeah, almost a Disney ending.
And then you think, or is it? I mean, it's just the end question.
No, I don't think they'll. If anything, I think people haven't seen the work when they hear you talking about it, us talking about it. They're going to want to see the play more.
Oh, I think so. I mean, how that ending defines itself in terms of the rest of the play. I mean, people have such a huge range of responses to it. You know, they'll laugh, sometimes they'll gasp, sometimes they'll, they'll sit there in total silence. But
McPherson is quite a writer.
He's a terrific writer.
And how did he react to the rehearsals? Now, because some... Albie has one way of doing it, and Mammoth has another way of doing it. That's not always so much fun.
No.
How is he to work with?
Oh, he's terrific. Yeah. I mean, he's acted himself, and so he has a very keen sense of stagecraft what works for an actor and what doesn't. And
so he writes for actors.
He writes for actors, very much so. Yeah. And, some of the ways he writes... He writes the gags, the jokes in it are, I mean, they're just an actor's dream. I mean, there's a setup over here, and you've got to have that just right, and then the payoff is like up to a page later.
A lot of people think you're such a strong character actor and a serious actor, but I think you have a comic bent to you that works well.
Oh, well, it's easy. It's easy to do with playwrights like Connor McPherson. He's got a real strong sense of comedy, and some of it's awfully broad. they're very character like jokes in a lot of his plays. Some there are a couple of lines in here that are just outright jokes.
Yeah,
they're just flat out jokes.
And what about the dance scene to the Marvin Gaye music?
Oh,
that to me summarizes the whole play.
Oh, it does. Yeah. It does in a lot of ways. Yeah. And Henry Wishkemper was very funny about the dance scene, of course, involves what's going on,
the Marvin Gaye song,
and the protest song. And so I, of course, got the words to it and brought it in. And Henry said, oh, that's right. You don't worry too much about those words. Because what he wanted me to do was sort of massacre, was sing along with it. And that's the stage direction. But he said he didn't really much care if I got the words right or not. In fact, if I got them wrong, that would be a bonus. So.
Yeah, because people really never get the words.
Oh, right. No. Yeah. I mean, they know a couple of the lines in it, but after that, you know, you're just.
But that was guessing. So priceless, and you got everybody started dancing, and
it's terrific. I mean, yeah. A little drunk, everybody's, mm-hmm. you know, and the relationship has progressed to the point where they're comfortable, and I don't know. It's a really nice moment.
Yes,
thank you, though.
Yeah. Oh well, the play is great, and it's running through.
Mid-November, I think.
November 16th.
November 16th. Yeah. Folks, you gotta see this play. It's one of the best plays of the year. And a good season. Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
And
we've got a terrific season.
So let's talk about your career.
Okay.
Is it true that you have made your living with your family and everything just being an actor?
For the last 25 years, yeah.
Wow.
I moved out to L.A., and this is more of a function of L.A. than it is my prowess as an actor. I went up and down Ventura Boulevard looking for a job as a waiter, and actors hold on to those jobs so desperately. I actually ended up with an acting job before I could get hired as a waiter.
Fantastic.
So,
well, you also to be a waiter there, don't you have to have a script in your? You
know, it certainly. You know,
everybody's got a script, right?
Yeah. One, yeah, you hope to have one anyway. But yeah, it's no. I've actually done quite well. It's like I was saying earlier. I'm the luckiest actor you'll ever clap eyes on. Really.
And this is right out of college, too.
Oh, no, not that. Right. Oh, right out of college. Right. I couldn't get arrested. I was up in Minneapolis. And, do you know those big inflatable tennis courts? You know?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I can build one of those. I know exactly how we're done, because we did that in the bitter cold up in Minneapolis.
But you got to know the original Steppenwolf guys, right?
Well, I went to school with everybody. Okay. Yeah. I mean, Terry Kinney was a freshman at the, so was Jeff Perry, and I knew Laurie Metcalf when she was a German major. Al Wilder when he was studying Russian, and then we all started doing plays in this little lab theater, and it was serendipitous. I mean, there were so many extremely talented people that were at Illinois State at the time. And, of course, you know, that ended up being sort of the core group of it. But, I mean, wonderful actors from all over, excuse me, sorry, dear. Wonderful actors from all over the country. But that was, I went to school with everybody.
So well, that was true. I didn't realize you all went to school together.
Illinois State.
Wow.
It's an old teacher's college down
sure.
in the cornfield between St. Louis and Chicago.
And then you guys all came.
Well, I went off to grad school and followed my then wife up to Minneapolis so she could go to school. And a couple of years later, they had started Steppenwolf, and I moved down to Chicago and joined them in 1979, about 3 years after they started.
So you were in Baum and Gilead.
Baum and Gilead?
Yeah, that's the one that put them on the map, right?
It really did. Yeah. It really did. It was a really interesting show. They had done it at Circle Rep in New York, of course. I keep wanting to say Gann Wilson. Wilson, first name.
Who are you talking about?
The playwright, Wilson.
August Wilson?
No. Not August. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
In any event, but he had written it for Circle Rep, and... we had another crack at it, I don't know, I guess it was about 10, 12, maybe 15 years after they had originally done it. And, I mean, we did that little postage stamp size theater.
Lanford Wilson.
Lanford, thank you. Bless you.
I knew I'd come up with it sooner or later.
And in that little tiny theater down at Hull House, which used to be down there at Belmont. And
I saw that. That was pretty wild stuff.
That was very wild. And when we took it to New York, Circle Rep picked it up again. And oh my gosh, the guys who were playing the street types, they'd go down to the toys district down in Manhattan, buy a bunch of this crap. I mean, you know, the toys and umbrellas and stuff like that. And they'd sell it to the patrons who came into the theater at half hour. They'd sit down and they'd sort of, come on, umbrella, $1, $1, $1, come on. And they'd sort of intimidate people into buying all this crap. And about every 2 or 3 months during the run, they'd throw this huge party with all the money that they made from the
That's junk great.
That yeah, it's great fun.
Yeah, that had to be fun. So then, of course, you went out. After doing shows at Steppenwolf, you went out to L.A.
Yeah.
Murder, She Wrote,
Star Trek.
Give me a few more.
Let me see. I did Murder, She Wrote. I played the killer first time, and then He Who Gets Killed. I was on that again a second time. Let me see. Murder, She Wrote. I picked up for a TV show called Erie, Indiana, which was sort of a Twilight Zone for tweens.
I've heard of it, but I don't.
It was on for one season. We shot 19. NBC showed 18 of them because they got scared of one of the episodes and they didn't want to. It was on for a season, and oh gosh, we just got murdered. It was the election. We were up against 60 Minutes. What else was it? Football. During football season. Yeah, I'm surprised.
I mean, let's talk about doomed, huh?
Yeah. But I mean, you know, I guess they stuck their neck out long enough to get us on for a season. It was beautifully written, though. Jose Rivera did a bunch of scripts for us.
Wow.
A brilliant playwright.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, favorite roles. I looked up an interview you did a few years back. And
what did I say?
Charlie in August, Osage County.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's right up there. It really is. Because you never know exactly it's that way for every play of Tracy Letts.
Well, he kind of wrote this play with a lot of you guys in mind.
Well, he did.
Yeah.
He did. And he wrote the Matty Faye for Rondi. Mm-hmm. Because that's the voice that was in Tracy's head, and he knew the relationship that Rondi and I had. We went to school together. I mean, Rondi was part of that whole
couple. She was part of that too.
Oh, she was at Illinois State as well, and so we were all hanging. We've known each other since we were children, and I have to say that. But with all of his plays, I mean, you stop and you look at the characters in it, and the plays are actually about each one of the characters. I mean, for instance, in Superior Donut, you follow the homeless woman. The play's about her.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that happens in the play has some sort of tangential effect on her characters, on her life. And so you can follow the play completely through her. What's that old gag about? What's Streetcar Named Desire about? Well, it's about this doctor that comes in and takes this crazy woman away that's been bothering this nice couple down in New Orleans. Of course, you know, he's there for a scene. But I mean, you can follow the entire story of the play through one character or another. And that's the way it worked for Charlie. I mean, you could, up until Charlie's last entrance, everything that happens in the play has a very deep effect on him.
That's, you know,
and he responds to it. The same with all the other characters as well. That's the reason it's so wonderful to do.
It's a great book. But one of my favorite roles is American Buffalo that you did.
Oh my gosh.
With Tracy and Patrick Andrews.
Patrick Andrews, That was such fun.
Yeah. That had to be interesting. Working with Tracy's got to be special.
Tracy's such a wonderful actor. Oh, gosh, I remember. Well, do you remember down at the old Hull House? Mm-hmm. Well, they did the Famous Door, did a production of The Conquest of the South Pole.
Yes.
Remember seeing that?
Yes.
Where they were like shushing over the tops, rooftops in East Berlin. And, it's a long story. He was fabulous in it. There's an image of him just burned in my brain from that production. And that was... That was easily 30 years ago.
Wow. Yeah, that's right. It was.
Yeah.
All right. In the interest of time, got a couple of standard questions I always ask. One is, what role are you dying to play that you haven't played?
What role am I dying to play that I haven't played? Well, this is, I should probably know better, but, and it's going to be a long while before I can play it because it's being done now. I'd love to play Lear, but I think I'd also like to do Winter's Tale.
I could see you in there.
Which would be great fun. And I've always thought too, it would be if you could do it, if you could pull it off. If you can do Cyrano, there's really nothing else to prove.
That's true.
You're having poetry. Yeah. You're sword fighting. Yeah. It's a romantic lead. It's you get to die at the end. It's terrific.
So. Okay. And what advice would you give to young people who just have this desire, they want to be an actor, they want to make a career out of it?
Wow. Well, pursue it. Do it. You always like to joke, I wouldn't wish that job on my worst enemy. But no, I mean, it's, I think what, the only advice I'd give is memorize your lines. Remember, it's a craft. It's not psychology. It's not psychotherapy. You have to get into the guts of a story and a character and kind of pull it apart and parse it out and then present it to an audience in a way that's comprehensible to them. You can't go up there and be. You just can't because you can't control that sort of stuff. And I remember it's a craft. That's what I would say. Remember, but go ahead and pursue it. Whatever dream.
I understand. Last question. I understand that you're going to play in a unique production. You're going to play Scrooge.
Oh,
coming up. Tell us about that. Coming up.
I don't even remember the actual title of it, but
it's got a crazy
subtitle.
Yeah.
Subtitle is Twist Your Dickens. what's going to be fun about it is that we're going to do it at the Goodman in the Owen.
Okay.
Second City is producing a lampoon of Christmas Carol, and we're going to be right across the hallway from Larry.
Yeah, from Larry Yondo.
Yeah. Larry Yondo. And, and the real production of Christmas Carol. And it'll be an antidote to all the good feelings that you have when you come out of Christmas.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Because we get so much of that, we want a little bit of...
Yeah, but Mr. Scrooge, it's Christmas. I don't care if it's Jesus's birthday. You still have to work.
Thank you so much.
Thank
Folks,
you.
Thanks for listening. And remember, go see a play this week.